Okay, is everybody warmed up and ready to sing? Okay. Rehoboam-Abijah, Asa, Jehoshaphat, Jehoram, Ahaziah, Athaliah, Joash, Amaziah, Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, Hezekiah, Manasseh, Haman, Josiah, Jehoahaz, Jehoiakim, Jehoiakim, Zedekiah. These are the kings of the land of Judah. Very good. Now, on the part of the kings of Israel. Jeroboam, Nadab, Baasha, Elah, Zimri, Omri, Ahab, with an Ahaziah here and a Joram there. Here, Jehu, there, Jehoahaz, everywhere, Joash, Jeroboam, Zechariah, Shalom, Menachem, Pekah, Hoshea. Very good. Very good. Better than last week, even. All right. Now, we have some things left over from last week. We saw this. Of course, we won't have to go over that again. We saw that. But as far as the characters that are involved in this, we learned certain lessons from them. I'd like to go over very quickly. Ahaziah, of course, the king who falls through the lattice and dies, is an idolater, a worshiper of Beelzebub. When you start out in Judges, you say, this is bad, it's going to crash, and there's a recovery. You see, in the book of Ruth, it was not all that way. And then you see, here comes Samuel, here comes David, and some things change, and you think things are on the up, and everything's going to be well. And then you come to this part in the Old Testament, and you see, here's idolatry raising its ugly head again. There's unbelief, no use for the true God. There's parental influence that brings it on, the very thing that Deuteronomy 17 and Deuteronomy 4 and 6 and other passages said, you must be diligent to teach these to your children. Talk about them when you're in the way and when you're doing your dishes and when you're drying the dishes and when you're giving baths and all this. They didn't do that. And so consequently, they got too busy and the generation grew up without knowing God and fell. The insult not only to Elijah, but especially to God, to bypass him to go down to the Philistine territory to see one of their gods instead of the gods of Israel. Things deteriorated rapidly after Jeroboam. And then the willful slight you see again in verse 8, where he has bypassed Elijah the prophet in order to do his own thing. The challenge to the true God, as you see in verse 9, sending 50 men to make the prophet do his bidding. So here you have a king trying to reduce Israel to the level of the kings about them. All those kings were the bosses in their territory. They told the prophets what to prophesy. They told the religious people what to do. In Israel, it was God who told the king what to do. This man has reversed that procedure to be like all the nations about him, and the consequence is he dies. He's a slow learner. He keeps sending others. And then he chose death over life. I think about Proverbs 27 in this regard, because it shows here in Proverbs 27, verse 22, though you grind a fool in a mortar with a pestle along with crushed grain, yet his foolishness will not depart from him. Well, that's Ahaziah. Remember the old drugstore days when you had the mortar and the pestle and you had the cup with the pusher and the crusher and you put stuff down in there to crush it up and you grind it and you push and you twist and you turn and it grinds it to powder. You think, well, I showed that a lesson. Well, here's a fool that's been put into that mortar and pestle and he hasn't learned a thing. He's fallen out to his death. He's not going to live, and he's still acting the way he does here in 2 Kings 1. It's hard to get foolishness out of a person. That's one thing I learned. And the other's in Jeremiah 2, verses 11 to 13, because Jeremiah had a way of calling people's attention to the foolishness that they were engaging in. Jeremiah 2, verse 11, and this is actually God speaking, of course. Has a nation changed its gods, which are not gods? But my people have changed their glory for what does not profit. That's what, so I should have that on the board here. Yeah. My people have changed their glory for what does not profit. Who would change a job so you can get fewer benefits and less pay? Nobody does that. These people have given up the God who has made them prosper, successful, well, and protected for one that's going to bankrupt them, make them sick, make them hurt, and make them the subject of all the enemy nations. Now that's bright, isn't it? He says, who acts this way? So in verse 12, be astonished, O heavens, at this, and be horribly afraid.
You need to be very afraid of people who are this foolish. Be very desolate, says the Lord, for my people have committed two evils. They have forsaken me, the fountain of living waters, and hewn themselves cisterns, broken cisterns that can hold no water. The heathen nations about them have committed one evil. They've just maintained their idolatry. These have given up the true God in order to go to the idols. So it's absurd in every level. Then when you think about Ahaziah's men, his captains, the first two go and very boldly are burned to a crispy crunch along with their men. The third one finally has some sense and he says, you know, I don't see much future in this. And his characteristics, I believe, are admirable. He's in a very bad situation, but it shows fear and pleading. You could add fear and trembling if you want to as well. He learned from the errors of others. I find this impressive. The first one didn't learn anything from it. The king hasn't learned anything, but this man watched. At least he learned about it. And he's not going to repeat it. You see, godly fear, he's afraid of the God of Israel and what he can do. His God can't do that. He counted the cost. He knows what's involved here. The humility with which he approaches the prophet here is amazing. Let my life be precious in your sight. Don't do to me what you did to those others, please. And then his faith. He knows God can do it. And I think here are various passages such as Isaiah 66 at verse 2. Isaiah 66, 2 says, for all those things my hand has made. He's talking about the heaven being his throne and earth his footstool. And all those things exist, says the Lord. But on this one will I look, on him who is poor and of a contrite spirit and who trembles at my word. It's always been the case. God is attracted to, he favors, he listens to the pleas of that kind of person. That was true from the beginning till now. And then you also notice in Luke 18, when you have the Pharisee standing there in the temple, he's praying, not really praying, but giving himself a pat on the back, saying, God, I thank you that I'm not like other men, extortioners and unjust, adulterers, or even as this tax collector. I fast twice a week. I give tithes of all that I possess. And I wondered, is this just a truncated part of his prayer? Probably went on for an hour like this, talking about how good he is, what great qualities he has. That doesn't matter, but I wouldn't be surprised, and you wouldn't either. But then the tax collector, standing afar off, would not so much as raise his eyes to heaven. He's unworthy, and he knows it. And he says, as he beats his breast, God be merciful to me, a sinner. And then in Acts 9, Saul of Tarsus, who will say in Acts 20, verse 4, the things that God has done for him to change him. And then you have also Elijah in 2 Kings 1. We can learn some things from Elijah here, the prophet of God. He chastises the king. He's a man who's fearless in this regard, though there were times when he's ready to quit and he's emotionally drained, probably. But he's chastising the king. He shows the consequences for the king's action. He shows the clout of a prophet of God in that he's willing to stand and to do what is right and to carry out God's will against the men who are more numerous and have more worldly power from the ostensible view than he does. The conviction of the prophet, verses 9 and 10, and the courage of the prophet. And verse 15, you contrast 1 Kings 19 where he's running away for fear and then he says, I'm the only one left, I'm ready to give up. And then you notice in Matthew 10, verse 28 to 31, Matthew 10, don't fear those who can kill the body and after that have nothing they can do to you, but rather fear him who is able to destroy both soul and body in hell. Now, he talks about birds. Two sparrows are sold for a copper coin, and yet not one of them falls to the ground apart from the Father's will. The very hairs of your head are all numbered. Do not fear, therefore. You're of more value than many sparrows. God knows our circumstances. He watches what we do. He watches for the purpose of wanting to see what is good, to bless us, and to see us through difficulties when we're trying to serve him. Any comments before we go on? Okay, that's last week's summary. Let's go to chapter 2. I would title this, unlike chapter 1, and one, chapter 1 I called A King Who Fell Twice and Died Twice. I would call this A Prophet Who Never Died Even Once. He won't die even once. He's taken out of the world, but he doesn't go through death in the normal way that we would think. In verse 1, it came to pass, when the Lord was about to take up Elijah into heaven by a whirlwind, that Elijah went with Elisha from Gilgal. I want to come back to verse 1 in a moment, so I'm going to leave that there unless someone has a point to make. But notice the taking up here. He's about to take up Elijah. Verse 2, then Elijah said to Elisha, "Stay here, please, for the Lord has sent me on to Bethel." But Elisha said, "As the Lord lives and as your soul lives, I will not leave you." So they went down to Bethel. Okay, Bethel. You think about Bethel in Genesis 28. What kind of a scene appeared as Jacob was leaving to go to Padan Aram and he spent the night in Bethel with his head on a stone? What did he see that night? We sing about it sometimes. He sees a ladder going up to heaven. What's on that ladder? Angels of God going up and down on this ladder. And so he wakes up and he says, this is some kind of special place, doesn't he? What does he say? This is the house of God. This is where God lives. That's what Bethel means, doesn't it? The house of God. Well, in 1 Kings 12 and 13, we come to Bethel again. What's happened to Bethel in the meantime? What is it now in 1 Kings 12? 1 Kings 11. Center for idols. That's where you have the golden calves along with Dan and the northern tribes. So, the Lord has sent me on to Bethel. And you would expect it to say, now I'm going to Bethel so that I can give them one last nudge, one last pinprick in their conscience to make them do what's right. And he says, Elisha says, I'm not going to leave you. And so they went down to Bethel. Let me pause and just make this point. Here's the prophet saying, I'm going to Bethel. You stay here. And he says, I will not. Is he disobeying God? Oh, yes, sir. I'm sorry. I didn't see you.
Back in 1 Kings 19, I think it was, that he would never leave.
That's what's going on here. Excellent answer. Excellent answer. So, this is faithfulness. It's not disobedience. Then the second question for you. I will not leave you. Here's a prophet nearing, now instead of death, he's nearing his departure from this world. It's not exactly death. But I will not leave you. Give me a great contrast to that attitude in the New Testament. I'll give you a clue. The word leave here in the Septuagint is the same word used in the New Testament to describe someone who does leave somebody, and it's translated in a different way than leave. That's true. But it's not the one I'm thinking of. You have to get the one I'm thinking of. Don't you love it? Demas has forsaken me, having loved this present world. Here's, and it fits with Jesus as well because he's ready to die. Here is a man who's been faithful all his life. Here's Demas who's had the privilege of being with him. Then he starts to see the doors shut and trapping him in, and he's going to end up just like Paul. I have some major business in Thessalonica. See you later, Paul. And he abandons him. Here's Elisha, and they're going to Bethel. But he says, no, where you go, I go to the end. So they went down to Bethel. Now, here's the strange part to me. Verse 3 tells us, the sons of the prophets who were at Bethel came out to Elisha and said to him, do you know that the Lord will take away your master from over you today? And he said, yes, I know. Keep silent. Look at that first line. Do you mean to tell me there are sons of the prophets at Bethel, at the very center of idolatry? Did you see that when you were reading for this class? It almost just goes right by you, doesn't it? It doesn't elaborate on it at all. We're going to see three groups of these prophets. But here's one at Bethel, at the heart of idolatry. This is Jeroboam's idolatry center. And you have these sons of the prophets who are there, who are faithful to the Lord. And they come out and they've already been communicating with God because they know that the Lord's going to take away Elisha's master from over him this day, the sons of the prophets seem to approach Elisha in these occasions, these three occasions. They don't seem to approach Elijah. I wonder if Elijah has his mind so set on what's about to take place. That's all he can think of. He seems to be already in another world. So they go to Elisha. Do you know the Lord's going to take your master away from you? And do you have a footnote for the expression, from over you? At verse 3. Take away your master from over you. From your head. What does he mean? Well, you remember in the ancient world, in the Jewish tradition, the rabbi would sit up there on an elevated seat, and the students would sit cross-legged down at his on the floor in front of him. Their heads would be about the level of his feet. You remember Acts 22, verse 3? I was brought up in this city at the feet of Gamaliel. His head is about eye level with Gamaliel's feet. He knew his feet very well. And that was the humbled position of a student who was learning from someone who was going to tell him the things he needs to do. And so he uses that expression here to describe that. Do you know that the Lord's going to take your master from over you today? And he said, yes, I know. Keep silent. What is that? What's that about? You know, there are some things that are too painful to talk about. Maybe that's what's going on here. I don't want to talk about this. I know a fellow who, it may be 2 years now, year and a half, 2 years, he lost his wife. Very faithful gospel preacher, many, many, many years. And his wife had been sick for some time and he died. And someone told me that whenever they go up to him to say something about some good deed she did, because she's really a beloved person, he just has to turn and walk away. He can't talk. He cannot say a word about his wife. I wonder if there's something like this here, because Elisha is indebted to Elijah for the greatest advancement in his life, giving up all of his worldly goods to follow God to achieve spiritual success and help others do the same. What a glorious, glorious call he's received. And so it gives me the impression he doesn't want to have his sorrow reminded of his sorrow. And it makes me think that Elijah is so preoccupied with heavenly thoughts, he doesn't say anything except, you stay here. Is your hand up? Okay. In Colossians 3, we are to have a heavenly mind, not one that does no earthly good, because Elijah and Elisha both did earthly good, but we're to be preoccupied with where we're going. Colossians 3, at verse 1, if then you were raised with Christ, seek those things which are above, where Christ is, sitting at the right hand of God. Set your mind on things above, not on things on the earth. For you died, and your life is hidden with Christ in God. If you were to look at Elijah, you wouldn't know he's as good as dead to this world. This world has no more attraction for him. He has very, very little time left in it. And his life, what it's going to be, the world can't even comprehend. It's totally hidden to them. But when Christ, who is our life, appears, and you will also appear with him in glory. This is also true of the Christian, Paul says. People look at us and they have no clue where we're headed, what we're like, and what we have looking forward to. Okay, any comments over that? Okay, if you look now at verse 4, then Elijah said to him, Elisha, stay here please, for the Lord has sent me on to Jericho. So he wants him to stay in Bethel this time. But he said, as the Lord lives, and as your soul lives, I will not leave you. So they came to Jericho. Now, Jericho is a great place of victory. If Bethel had brought up some really sad connotations and memories, this brings up very good memories in so many ways. But the sons of the prophets who were at Jericho came to Elisha, and they said to him, do you know that the Lord will take away your master from over you today? So he answered, yes, I know. Keep silent. And then in verse 6, Elijah said to him, stay here, please, for the Lord has sent me on to the Jordan. But he said, as the Lord lives and as your soul lives, I will not leave you. So the two of them went on. And 50 men of the sons of the prophets went and stood facing them at a distance while the two of them stood by the Jordan. So it's about 5 miles, approximately, depending on where they are at this specific point, to the Jordan from Jericho, where they are. And so we're told in verse 8, Elijah took his mantle, rolled it up, and struck the water, and it was divided this way and that, so that the two of them crossed over on dry ground. Now, striking the water conjures up a lot of memories in the past and what was done typically with a rod, but when you fold up your mantle and it's made of leather and you hit something, it's kind of like a rod. I think of Exodus 7, verse 20. Moses and Aaron did as the Lord commanded. So he lifted up the rod and struck the waters that were in the river in the sight of Pharaoh and in the sight of his servants. And all the waters that were in the river were turned to blood. So there's a mighty powerful rod there, right? Not the rod, but the God is behind it. And people could see that. Exodus 8:16, still in Egypt. So the Lord said to Moses, say to Aaron, stretch out your rod and strike the dust of the land so that it may become lice throughout all the land of Egypt. And they did so, and it became lice. Then Numbers 20:11, Moses lifted his hand and struck the rock twice with his rod. Water came out abundantly, and the congregation and their animals drank. Especially Exodus 14:21, Moses stretched out his hand over the sea. The Lord caused the sea to go back by a strong east wind all that night, made the sea into dry land, and the waters were divided. And then did the Jordan prior to this time ever divide? Was there a time when it separated? When was that? Joshua's entry, yes, Joshua 3:13. It shall come to pass as soon as the soles of the feet of the priests who bear the ark of the Lord of all the earth, shall rest in the waters of the Jordan, that the waters of the Jordan shall be cut off, the waters that come down from upstream, and they shall stand as a heap, a wall of water, a miniature Red Sea event as they enter the land. So as they're leaving Egypt, as they're wandering in the wilderness, as they're now entering Canaan, all these miracles with a rod or a hand or something of that nature, whether it involves water, sea, dust, river, all the same powerful God who's behind it all. Well, here we have very similar thing going on in verse 8. Elijah takes the mantle, rolls it up, strikes the water, and it divided this way and that, and they cross over on dry ground. Sounds very familiar, doesn't it? That's Joshua 3 all over again. So it was, verse 9, when they had crossed over, that Elijah said to Elisha, ask, what may I do for you before I am taken away from you? Elisha said, please let a double portion of your spirit be upon me. Okay, a couple of things about this. James 5:16, the prayer, the effectual, fervent prayer of a righteous man avails much. Here's a righteous man. That's James 5:16. What do the next two verses illustrate that with? Elijah. Elijah prayed fervently that it would not rain, and 3 years and 6 months go by without rain, and then he prayed again, and it rained. Well, here is this man who has this, some would say, this connection with God, this relationship with God. And he asks you on his last day, what can I do for you? Now, a lot of people in the world will think he is their magic genie. They can just rub and get the pot of gold or everything they've ever wanted, right? What is it that he's going to ask for? It's going to be a spiritual blessing, and not even mainly for himself, but a double portion of his spirit. That's going to be a great blessing on everyone he comes in contact with. A dying person oftentimes blesses those who are left behind. You remember any illustrations of this prior to this? Where a dying man blesses those who are left behind? Think of Jacob in Genesis 49. He blesses his sons and tells what's going to happen to them. People look at this and they say, wow, if I were given this, I would ask for, and they mention things that perish. They're going to outlive every one of those things. They'll live for eternity, and these things will go to rust before long. Elisha asks for spiritual things. So, they crossed over. Elijah turns to Elisha. He's heavenly minded. He can't think about anything else, but he does know that the success of his people will depend upon now the success of this man who follows him. So he says, what is it I can do for you? Ask what I may do for you before I'm taken away from you. Elisha said, please let a double portion of your spirit be upon me. Okay, a double portion of your spirit. What in the world does that mean? Deuteronomy 21:17 talks about a father that has several children. What does the oldest get? A double portion. Is it a double portion more than the father himself has? Than the giver? No, he couldn't give that much, could he? That wouldn't make sense. What is it a double portion with reference to? What everybody else gets. And so, Elisha's not saying, Elijah, I want to have twice as many miracles as you've done. I want to have twice the influence you've had. None of that is what he's asking for. None of that even happened. Elijah is referred to in 1 and 2 Kings. He's referred to in Chronicles. He's referred to in Malachi, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, James. Elisha is referred to one more time after he gets out of this context, and that's in Luke 4:26. There's no way he even compares in regard to notoriety with Elijah. But he's not asking for that. He wants twice as much as the others with him. If he's going to be training them, he wants twice as much as they have. Isn't that a fair request? You're going to be teaching something, he knows everything you know. You're at a slight disadvantage, aren't you? But if you have twice as much, whatever this is, as they do, now, you can fill out of your cup and make their cup get fuller. And so that's what he's asking for. What all this involves in specifics, I can't get very specific. But I know that's the emphasis of it, and that's the spiritual nature of it, and that's very important. In verse 10, so he said, you have asked a hard thing. That means this is something that only God can grant. I can't give it to you. David. Very possible. Yeah. I wouldn't affirm a negative. You'll notice in verse 10, you've asked a hard thing. If you see me when I'm taken from you, it shall be so for you. But if not, it shall not be so. It's the Lord's decision. So the sign will be if you see me when I'm taken from you. Then verse 11, it happened as they continued on and talked, that suddenly a chariot of fire appeared with horses of fire and separated the two of them. And Elijah went up by a whirlwind into heaven. Now, there's a lot about verse 11 we cannot know. But one of the things we can know is this is one way to travel. Only God can send a chariot of fire and horses of fire. We wouldn't even dream of something like this. What God can do and what He can do in taking someone to heaven or blessing someone to heaven is so far above our poor ability to comprehend that we can't even come close. And this is one thing we learn here. Another thing, it tells us that they continued on and they talked. We'll say more about that in a moment, I hope. But this chariot of fire appears. That chariot of fire will occur again in chapter 6 when the king of Syria is harassing the people of Dothan. He knows what he needs to do to get the better part of Israel. They tell him, Elisha's telling them everything, and that's how the king is dodging you. So, in verse 14, he sent horses. 2 Kings 6:14. The king of Syria sends horses and a great army. They came by night and surrounded the city. Now, what are you going to do? You're a prophet, Elisha, with one servant. And this city is surrounded by horses and soldiers. You just go out with a white flag and say, I'm sorry, I surrender, right? No. Remember, he has been in chapter 2. He has seen what God can do. He has seen real chariots and real horses. They're made of fire. So, in verse 15, the servant went out to get water. I think he said to get out to get water. Anyway, he rose and went out. And there was an army surrounding the city with horses and chariots. And his servant said, alas, my master, what shall we do? He said, do not fear, For those who are with us are more than those who are with them. And Elisha prayed and said, Lord, I pray, open his eyes that he may see. The Lord opened the eyes of the young man, and he saw. And behold, the mountain was full of horses and chariots. Well, they had horses and chariots. What's the difference? Horses and chariots of fire. All around Elisha. What's the point of the horses and chariots? What do? Practically speaking. They protect. How many men of Syria said, oh, we can take them. Let's go get those horses and chariots of fire. Not one. Not one. They know their limitations. They don't want to die this day. And he goes on to describe how he led them blind to the king and then sent them back after feeding them. Quite humbled. And the king said, I think we're through with this kind of mission for a while. We'll try something else. Try some other prophet. Now, back in chapter 3 then, this is the, or chapter 2 I should say, this is the second time that we see the chariots of fire. The first is here. The second one is there. Elisha saw it and cried out, my father, this is verse 12. Or we didn't finish verse 11, did we? A chariot of fire appeared with horses of fire and separated the two of them, and Elijah went up by a whirlwind into heaven. Now, I don't know how to view what's taking place. I've always viewed the chariot as something he gets in. That's the vehicle with which you are transported, and the fuel is the whirlwind. Now, you can say that he goes by whirlwind, just like we can say when we get in our car, you may be sitting in a car, but you're going because of the fuel, because of the gases in it. Without the gas, you're not going anywhere. We would say, concerning a person who is ready to take off in a plane, what kind of speed are you going to have? What kind of power? Well, I don't have any because there's no fuel in it, but I'm in the chariot. I'm in the plane. That won't help anybody. But he was in a chariot fueled by the fire. Now, if it's not that way, then it's just simply saying the fire that made this thing go was the whirlwind itself. And it doesn't actually say that he got into the chariot. So it may be that the chariot is just a symbol. And it's saying the symbol here is God is the true chariot and horses that protect Israel, just as you'll see in chapter 6. And then it just mentions the whirlwind that takes Elijah up. Take either one you want. I don't know. Brother Jerry.
You know, I was thinking about that. It says that the chariot fire separated the men. Then it says he was taken up in the whirlwind.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't say anything about that he went up.
That he went up in the chariot. Yes.
And if he did, then did those horses end up in heaven?
I wouldn't think so.
I wouldn't think so.
Yeah, I wouldn't think the whirlwind would either, though. But still, it's gonna work out. And I don't even know what the people thought about when they viewed Elijah as being taken up, because they think the Lord's dropped him somewhere. So they may think it's just a spiritual event instead of a physical one. We do know that in verse 12, Elisha saw it, and he cried out, my father, the chariot of Israel and its horsemen. That means he is the defense of Israel. The defense of Israel doesn't depend upon what size army you have. It depends upon your relationship with this God who has all power. He took hold of his own clothes and tore them into two pieces. Just as Reuben, when he got back to the place where his brothers were, tore his garment when he saw Joseph was not there. When they get back to tell their father, he tears his clothes. When Job sees what's happened to his family, he tears his clothes. It's a very common thing to show grief by tearing your clothes right in two. And so, in verse 13, after tearing his clothes, it tells us in 14, he took the mantle of Elijah that had fallen from him and struck the water and said, where is the Lord God of Elijah? When he also had struck the water, it was divided this way and that, and Elisha crossed over. So when he says, where is the Lord God of Elijah, is he with me or is he not? We'll see. And he strikes it, and the event answers the question for him. In 15, the sons of the prophets from Jericho saw him. They said, the spirit of Elijah rests on Elisha. They saw what he did apparently in parting the river here. And they came to meet him and bowed to the ground before him. This word bowed is the word typically in the New Testament that means to worship. But the context determines it. Its first root meaning was to bow in respect before someone you consider greater. And then it's used in Matthew 2 and following in the first times in the New Testament of worshiping Jesus, even as a baby. He was worthy of true worship. They didn't just bow, they worshiped. Matthew 2:11. Then verse 16, then they said to him, look now, there are 50 strong men with your servants. Please let them go and search for your master, lest perhaps the Spirit of the Lord has taken him up and cast him upon some mountain or into some valley. Well, did they believe God took his soul and discarded his body? And he needed a decent burial because God's dropped his body somewhere and we at least ought to give him a decent burial? Or was it like Obadiah the prophet in 1 Kings 18 that he says, I'm not going to go tell Ahab you're here, Elijah, because as soon as I go, the Spirit of the Lord will catch you away, take you to some foreign land, and I won't have any idea where you are, and they'll kill me. Then maybe that's what they thought. I have no idea what they're thinking. Whatever it is, it's wrong. They hadn't seen what was going on. They didn't know the power of God. So they still need Elisha's help, and this illustrates that fact. So there are 50 here. Notice it mentions the prophets in three different places. Now, if there are 50 in Jericho and 50 in Bethel and 50 there at the Jordan, and they talk about his master going up, going up, going up. You know that your Lord's going to go up today. Your master's going to go up. That's the theme of 2 Kings 1. The 50 and the 50 and the 50. You come down, Elijah. Well, let's let the fire come down on you. Come down, Elijah, quickly. Let the fire of God come down upon you. Elijah, I'd like for you to come down, but I'm not going to ask you to do anything because I know you burned up those other tombs, so be kind to me. And so he goes. And so you have the 50-50-50 there. You have possibly the 50-50-50 here. And in verse 16, he goes on to point out, you shall not send anyone. Elisha knows this is futile. He knows Elijah has gone up to where he needs to be, and God doesn't make any mistakes in these things. You shall not send anyone. They urged him till he was ashamed. He said, send them. Therefore, they sent 50 men, and they searched for 3 days, but did not find him. When they came back to him, for he had stayed in Jericho, he said to them, did I not say to you, do not go? It feels pretty good to say, I told you, you just wouldn't listen. So now he has even more credibility than before. Comments on any of these? Matt?
There's so many parallels between Moses and Elijah.
Many.
But as between the two of them, Elijah's the one that's taken together, and not Moses.
Moses has the time.
And even if they sinned, they did it in some of the ways out of frustration, out of what they're having to do.
Exactly. A good sermon would compare Moses and Elijah and all these salient points. And those are the two that are on the Mount of Transfiguration. Brother Dave.
In verse 12, uh-huh. that expression, Elisha cried out, my father, the chariot of Israel. Joash said the same thing to Elisha when he was
exactly.
dying. And the father is like a title or a spiritual leader. And the chariot of Israel, the national defender.
Exactly. Well put. Any others? Okay. We have about a minute. The men of the city said to Elisha, please notice, the situation of this city is pleasant, as my Lord sees, but the water is bad and the ground barren. You know, the typhoid used to be a major problem with water. Willie Lincoln died at the age of 11, lived in the White House, and had polluted water, and they're pretty sure it was typhoid that killed him at the age of 11. Incredible. Used to be a major problem. Here's a problem here. The water's bad and the ground is barren. So he said, bring me a new bowl and put salt in it. So they brought it to him. He went out to the source of the water and cast in the salt there and said, thus says the Lord, I've healed this water. From it there shall be no more death or barrenness. So the water remains healed to this day according to the word of Elisha, which he spoke. The question had been, after Elijah leaves, will the people use Elisha? Elijah's gone. Will they use Elisha as they had Elijah? Let him continue to train and to bless them spiritually so that they will be the giants they need to be in order to bring Israel back. You can see they've already invaded Bethel, the enemy territory. I find that absolutely the most incredible verse in this whole chapter, that they're in Bethel. 50. Or at least a number of the good prophets who are doing the will of God. Okay, time is gone. Any comments? Okay, thanks for your help tonight.